From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast, hosted by Paul Hanley.
Welcome to part two of my discussion with Dr. Michael Green on the China in the World podcast. During the part two discussion, Dr. Green and I analyze U.S. and Chinese approaches to the North Korea nuclear problem. We explore different proposals which could work to make progress on the issue and improve U.S.-China cooperation along the way. We also turn our attention to the upcoming summit between President Trump and Chinese President Xi in early April in Mar-a-Lago. Our conversation picks up where we left off on part one of the discussion, and if you haven't done so already, I'd encourage you to go back and listen to part one as well. On North Korea, we have seen since February now, the North Koreans have done, just this month alone, two missile tests, one which included multiple missiles. North Korea and the leadership is widely assumed to be behind the assassination of Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother of the leader Kim Jong-un. Diplomatic relations during the time of your visit here to Beijing between Malaysia and North Korea have deteriorated to the point that neither country now will allow their respective citizens to leave. Following the latest missile test, we saw the U.S. and South Korea begin to roll out the first pieces of the missile defense system, the THAAD system, in South Korea. President Trump got on the phone, talked to the Japanese prime minister, the acting South Korean president. They emphasized U.S. ironclad commitment to stand with Japan and South Korea in the face of the serious threat posed by North Korea. The Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi held a press conference yesterday, called on North Korea to suspend its nuclear program, but at the same time, he cautioned the United States in unusually frank language to say that the United States and South Korea should not deploy this THAAD system, vehemently opposed by the Chinese side. And he used a phrase saying the two sides are like two accelerating trains coming towards each other. The question is, are the two sides really ready for a head-on collision? From your discussions this week, I'd like to listeners to get a sense of your main takeaways in terms of the Chinese position. How frustrated are they with the North? What, if anything, are they willing to do about it? Why are they opposed to the missile defense system? And how much tension do you think this will cause in the relationship that China has, both with the U.S. and South Korea?
You know, in early 2005, President Bush sent me from the White House to Asia with letters for the leaders of China and Japan and Korea. And when I came to Beijing, I was taken to deliver the letter in person to President Hu Jintao, which was a surprise to me and a big change in protocol, given that I was just special assistant to the president. And later, North Korea that week, North Korea tested missiles. And the New York Times said it was because
I got... Seems to happen every time.
Well, the New York Times actually had an article where someone said it was because Hu Jintao saw me. So maybe you made a mistake inviting me.
Inviting you, yeah.
So anyway, look, Wang Yi, who went to Georgetown University where I teach and who I worked with in the six-party talks process, is a very experienced diplomat, very knowledgeable. His metaphor is wrong. This is not like two speeding trains heading towards each other. This is like a speeding train heading towards a giant mountain. And the speeding train is North Korea, and the giant mountain is the U.S. and the U.S. alliance system. And if China doesn't want a big collision, it's going to have to focus on slowing down that train, slowing down Kim Jong-un's rapidly accelerating tests of missiles, nuclear weapons, and his demonstration in Malaysia that he's prepared to use biological warfare. Kim Jong-nam was reportedly killed with VX agent, which is a biological agent that North Korea has and could mount on missiles to hit U.S. forces or Japan. That mountain, the U.S.-Korea alliance, U.S.-Japan alliance, is not going to move. And the move that was made to deploy THAAD to Korea are ongoing exercises with Korea, a likely increase in defense spending and resources for this region by the U.S., and increasing U.S.-Japan-Korea cooperation, including on missile defense, all these things are going to keep happening because the mountain, it can see a collision coming, and people on the mountain are putting up more bricks and more stones to defend themselves. The Chinese side has made very clear its opposition to THAAD deployment, but the American president, no American president, is going to remove THAAD because of Chinese objections. Of course, it is an important goal for the U.S. and for South Korea to work with China to help resolve this problem. But the highest moral responsibility of any leader is to protect their people. And that's true for the U.S. and it's true for South Korea. And China's proposal, Wang Yi's proposal, with all respect, to freeze missiles, missile launches in exchange for a decrease in U.S.-Korea exercises is not going to be accepted by Seoul or Washington, because both the U.S. and Korea have to defend ourselves. And we're not going to say, well, in order to accelerate or help China with diplomacy, we're going to leave our troops exposed to this guy, Kim Jong-un, who clearly is willing to use nerve agents, continue developing nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. Impossible. And I think basically impossible in South Korea.
Talk about South Korea, because a lot of people talk about South Korea, the political turmoil right now that you see in South Korea, the fact that a potentially liberal candidate could come into office and potentially change their policy with respect to North Korea, be more accommodating, try to do more with the North, maybe move away from THAAD. Is that a possibility in your mind? You hear a lot of this in China. It may be wishful thinking. I'd be interested to get your perspective.
Wishful thinking. Korea is a divided political culture. The left and right are at odds. Perhaps people in Beijing thought if they keep raising opposition to THAAD, they can carry out a classic united front strategy and isolate the conservatives who are strongly supportive of THAAD and build up opposition to THAAD among liberals and progressives and business. It didn't work. It had the opposite effect.
They're putting quite a bit of pressure on South Korea through economic means and
it's a big mistake.
Tourism.
It's a big mistake. Yes, Korea is a smaller country than China and depends on the Chinese economy for its growth. But again, the Korean government's highest obligation is to defend their people. And this threat is very serious, not only for U.S. forces, but of course for South Korea. And I think the Chinese side completely miscalculated, because even if the progressive camp wins, no Korean president can say, we're going to disarm in the face of this North Korean threat. It's not going to happen. And I think that the Chinese side knows that.
Yeah.
I think they know they miscalculated. I think that you'll see them soften their tone. The public now is quite angry about that because of a lot of, you know, frankly, misinformation about the THAAD system. And there will be some bumps in the China-Korea relationship. But it's in China's interests to get past that, because they're just driving Korea closer to Japan, closer to the U.S., and building up resistance to China within Korean politics.
I've been struck by the kind of things that they've been doing with South Korea. The Lotte department store, they've sort of stopped construction of that in the northeast part of China. Yeah. South Korean Airlines, I think Jeju Airlines, was looking for new routes into China. They disapproved those. They're lowering the number of tourists going to South Korea. They're apparently coming right out of the tourism ministry, these announcements. It's clearly, you know, economic pressure that they're applying to South Korea to change the political calculus of political leaders in South Korea. It's the kind of thing that we're sort of asking the Chinese to do to North Korea, but they say they're sort of principally against sanctions and economic pressure. If you were sitting in the National Security Council now as senior director for Asia, writing the memo for General McMaster's and President Trump on the kind of ways we should move forward to get the North Koreans to stop and reverse and eliminate the North Korean nuclear program, what are the elements of the strategy that you would recommend?
Well, let me first quickly touch on this retribution or retaliation against Korean firms. This is a very self-defeating move by the Chinese side. Either by fomenting popular boycotts or by actively having a hand in them, the Chinese government risks two long-term consequences. One is Korean companies will be much more hesitant about investing in China. The assessment of political risk will go up. And frankly, the Koreans will do what the Japanese did when this happened to them, which is diversifying their investment to India, to Vietnam, and especially to North America. And the Koreans are good businessmen, and they're going to factor in this as a long-term risk, even if it stops in a few months. The second effect is that for those in the United States or Japan who think we should be using economic tools against China, we don't. We don't, you know, single out the Chinese firms that were involved in the dredging in the South China Sea. But those there are voices in Washington and Tokyo and even in Europe in some places that are saying to get China to change its behavior, we need to target companies and punish them. And for the most part, businesses...
Well, you hear that in the context of North Korea, of course, the secondary sanctions.
Not just North Korea. South China Sea, Taiwan, human rights. So if China uses these mercantile sort of weapons, if it uses economic as weapons, they open themselves up. Because the U.S. system is much more it's much more difficult to use economic tools, frankly, because our private sector is so important, Congress and state governors.
Sure.
But China's going to find that in the U.S., this creates more support for doing to China what China's doing to South Korea, which would not be good. On the memo to McMaster's, I would say, number one, we have got to defend our people and our allies. And that is a much higher priority than dialogue. And we're not, and we won't, trade our defense and security and deterrence against this very dangerous and growing threat in order to get diplomacy, because you and I have worked in the six-party talks, Paul. They're important. We work very hard on them. It's pretty obvious now that you get very, very limited returns, if any returns at all, on diplomacy. So that's number one. Number two, let's try to think of ways that we can limit the North Korean threat. We're not, in the longer term, medium to long term, we need to set up a condition through sanctions and pressure, and yes, perhaps some dialogue, that we convince North Korea to give up nuclear weapons. But in the foreseeable future, that is just not going to happen. And our strategy has been aimed at that, at trying to get them to change their calculation and give up nuclear weapons. That's not going to happen in the, under Kim Jong-un. And so let's shift a little bit.
Surely won't happen through dialogue by itself. That's for sure.
And I'm frankly skeptical that pressure, that we or China can mount enough pressure that Kim Jong-un will decide he'll give up nuclear weapons. I just think for his survival, he sees them as too important. We should, that's a longer term strategy. We should look at creating the pressure and diplomatic environment where he or his successor decide it's not worth having nuclear weapons. We should constantly do that. But in terms of results, we're talking a longer term prospect. So in the near term, what we ought to focus on, I would say to General McMaster's, is let's get some immediate reduction of the threat. Not with a freeze or something that North Korea can easily violate and that would require us to not do our first priority, which is defending ourselves. Not something like that. Let's find some very specific cases where the U.S. and China and other like-minded countries intercept North Korean ships, stop North Korean planes, produce containers or cargo holds with missile parts, with precursors for reprocessing, with things related to North Korea's missile and nuclear programs, consistent, entirely consistent with the authorities of the UN Security Council resolutions. Let's do that. Let's showcase it. Let's show that U.S. and China are working together to reduce the threat, not for regime change, but to like policemen to catch the robbers. I think if you if China really did that, the American public would, then I think Congress and the American public would say, okay, we're on the same side with China. They're helping us in very specific ways catch the bad guys, dangerous materials, and you know this is not easy work. Our Chinese friends tell us this is hard work, but that's exactly why it's so important and would be so powerful as a symbol of U.S.-China cooperation.
So the presidents, apparently President Trump and President Xi, word is that they're going to meet fairly soon, maybe in the U.S., potentially in Mar-a-Lago. There's a North Korea policy review ongoing in the interagency being led by the National Security Council. You expect this to be on the agenda? What would you expect to see at this first meeting between the two presidents? You've also talked this week about Prime Minister Abe from Japan, his successful trip to the United States, went to Washington, D.C. They flew down on Air Force One to Mar-a-Lago, did, I think, 36 rounds of golf. They seem to have figured out how to have a good visit. What lessons should the Chinese take away from that?
So Abe had a very good visit. So did Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada. One reason is because they are very strong politically at home. And there's not that much anti-American nationalism in Japan, really. And so they had room, both of them, to work on the relationship and not produce a result.
Yeah.
Although Abe did get one. I think Xi Jinping is in a strong position politically, but I think there's more popular anti-Americanism and nationalism in China that will make, frankly, it make him limit what he can do. He'll have to look strong in a way Abe or Trudeau didn't. But that said, I still think he can have a pretty successful summit. I think he should avoid asking for things or demanding things. That will trigger Donald Trump's negotiating.
We saw this from the Australian Prime Minister.
Australian Prime Minister, the Mexican call. President. Big mistake. Understandable, but big mistake asking for things. The One China policy confirmation, that's enough for now. I think what Xi Jinping should spend his time on is, number one, reviewing U.S.-China relations. You know, Trump's criticism of Japan was based on the 1980s. He really doesn't know much about modern Japan. And Abe-san spent about 70% of the meeting talking and describing what's going on in Asia, what's going on in Japan. I think without demanding or pressing, just simply reviewing U.S.-China relations, the benefits, some of the difficult areas, but, you know, especially the benefits.
Well, my sense is if President Xi talks about what he's trying to accomplish here at home, here in China,
very good idea,
with respect to their economic reforms and creating jobs, and there seemed, I would think there would be some crossover.
As you'll recall, Jiang Zemin did that with President Bush and it had a big impact. Jiang and President Hu described what they're trying to achieve in China.
25 million jobs, I think.
The president, remember that he wrote in his book that the number one thing that those two leaders thought about was how do we create 25 million new jobs?
Exactly.
So I think that's a good idea. President Xi should describe his reform plans, his domestic aspirations. Don't negotiate right away. And then, you know, what Abe did in creating a long-range strategic dialogue in economics between Vice President Pence and Deputy Prime Minister Aso is kind of an interesting model. I personally don't think that the Trump administration will continue the strategic and economic dialogue. I kind of doubt they'll do that. And I don't think the Chinese side should put too much weight on that. You know, it's a different president. It's important to have more important than the structure is getting the right people on the two sides talking. So a good outcome for U.S.-China relations would be some kind of initial thought about who on each side would form a dialogue. And report back to the presidents.
So I think the Chinese side has expressed their hope that the strategic and economic dialogue continues. And so it will be interesting to see what the administration does. I mean, I agree with you. I think it requires, you know, relooking at this thing to see how it can be done in a way that's frankly more effective for the U.S. and for the relationship. So the question is, what do they do the first round? Do they keep it the first round and then discuss together what new framework they could put together? Or do they sort of cancel it without anything in mind in terms of what to do going forward?
I have no opposition to the strategic and economic dialogue, but I think if the relationship waits for the strategic and economic dialogue to start up again, we'll have a huge vacuum. So I just don't think the relationship needs to hang on that structure. I think it's more important that the two leaders establish some trusted confidence the way Bob Zelik and Dai Bingguo or Hillary Clinton and Dai Bingguo had strategic dialogue and begin reviewing the relationship and put it in a process. And very important that the Japanese asked for Vice President Pence. They were worried that Peter Navarro or more nationalistic or mercantilistic, right, people would immediately try to negotiate trade concessions, so on, right, and so forth. Important to have trusted
counterparts
talk, yeah, about the long-term vision for U.S.-China relations. Don't announce a big new model of great power relations. Don't look for a big headline or, yeah, a big six-character phrase. Start getting the right people together to begin building in the pieces and report back to the presidents and get a process going. Strategic and economic dialogue, that'll take too long to start up. There'll be a vacuum. There'll be huge fights in the U.S. about who's in it and who's out.
So what should we expect at this first meeting then? I mean, what's your sense?
Good photo.
Photo op.
A photo op. The Xi Jinping is not going to have the same warm relationship that Abe did. It's just, they're different people. The relationships, yeah, are different. And I don't think President Xi plays golf, although I don't know.
Not that I'm aware of. Seems to me the most important thing is he's seen by the Chinese people, at least, to be being treated with respect by the U.S. president.
Yeah, I mean, that was true for Trudeau and for Abe. They needed, yeah, to show their publics they were treated with respect, and, yeah, they were. Yeah. So I think, in some ways, that may be the most important thing, just sort, right, of show a certain amount of respect. I like your idea to describe what she's trying to do with the Chinese economy. Listen to Donald Trump asking what his vision is. As two leaders, try to understand each other.
Yeah.
And try to come out of this with some idea who between the two governments can continue the dialogue, not in a huge S&ED, but in something like the Zelic Diving Guo dialogue to prepare for the next meeting and the meeting after that.
Great. Well, Mike, we've really enjoyed having you out here in Beijing this week. Would love for you to come back. Thank you for doing the China and the World podcast a second go-around. We welcome you back for a third go-around. Really enjoyed talking to you about these issues today. Thank you for spending time with the Center. That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China and the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. I also encourage you to buy and read Mike Green's new book, By More Than Providence, Grand Strategy and American Power in the Asia Pacific in 1783. I think it's available on Amazon and Kindle. Is that right?
Apparently, you can get it faster in China and Japan than you can in the U.S.
Well, thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next time. Thanks again, Mike.
Thank you.